People, when they go to get their visas, they're only thinking about themselves. They're not actually thinking about the person who's doing the job on the other end. I was thinking about that person. You see what they go through and how frustrating and stressful it actually is. And I think because I was trying to be considerate and empathetic and like noticing that helped me. And I think that that's how I got my visa so quickly.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode number 61 of the Immigrants Life podcast, where we share stories of people who left their country to chase a better life. And through these stories, you can learn what living abroad is really like, what challenges we have to go through, and how to successfully move and settle in a new country. I'm Daniel De Biasi, and my guest this week is an international life coach from the US. Monday Stories is one of a kind. She traveled all around the world and lived in the UK and France. Back home in the United States, Monday was part of the Air Force. That was actually her first job after graduating from college. But when she and her husband moved to England after she left the military, Monday started a completely new career as a chef and worked in a French restaurant. A few years later, they moved to France, where she found a job as an assistant for an Australian astronomer in Paris. It might sound like quite a transition for a former Air Force soldier, but more and more people were interested in the services because she was good at organizing, managing, and tidying things up. To the point that she started her own apartment managing company and grew really quickly. Building a successful business is not an easy thing to do, especially when you are in a foreign country and you don't speak the local language. So no doubt Monday knows how to adapt and turn challenges into opportunities. Now she uses her knowledge and experience to help other immigrants find their purpose in life and overcome the challenges that most of us face when starting a new life abroad. In this episode, we are going to talk about culture shock, racism, and the difference between the US and Europe, how to find your purpose and achieve your goals. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Monday. Hey, Monday, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You are originally from the United States.
And yes.
The United States is a huge immigration destination for many, many people. You were born and raised in the US. Why did you decide to leave the US and move abroad?
I decided to move abroad when I was in the military and I was getting out of the military and I had always wanted to kind of travel. And in the military, I didn't actually get to travel that much. I didn't get to travel outside of the United States. And America was kind of changing at that point. It was the year I was supposed to either decide to continue to be in the military or to get out and sort of live my life differently was the year the second George Bush was running for president. I knew, you know, as history shows, that Republicans normally like to go to war. So I was like, if I stay in the military, I'm pretty sure that, you know, I will be going to war at some point in another term. I knew the agenda of, you know, sort of George Bush and his vision for America. And that really wasn't the kind of life that I wanted to live anymore. I didn't like the sort of super capitalist vision of the world. I wanted something that was just felt a bit more safer. And also I wanted to travel and it was a lot more easy for me to travel if I was inside of Europe than if I was in the United States. So there were lots of factors why I decided to leave.
Why you decided to join the army?
I decided to join the Air Force because, as you know, United States, like, education is astronomical. And when I got out of high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do for a career. And so I did not want to go to university and spend my parents' money for something. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my parents were like, either you go to university or you're an adult and you move out and you're on your own. So at 18, I really had to make a decision. How am I going to take care of myself, pay for education once I do decide what I want to do with my life? It really was sort of a choice out of survival, I would say, more than I wanted to join the Air Force. I had never thought about joining the military until that point in my life.
And so when you left the Air Force, you start traveling. What was your idea? Was like traveling for a bit and then go back to the US? Or what was your idea when you start traveling and seeing the world?
Well, at first I came to your neck of the woods. I was like, I'm going to check out Canada. I was like, it seems like it's pretty nice over there. So I went to, at first I went to Vancouver and I checked out Canada, which was completely beautiful and I loved it, but it still felt very American to me. And I really wanted to have different culture. I wanted to experience something that was completely different than anything I had ever experienced before. And so I got the opportunity to go to the UK. And yeah, and I left and I went to the UK and I never looked back, pretty much.
And how did you manage to go to the UK?
Well, wow, that's a long story. At the time, I was married to my best friend. And we had kind of gotten married to stay together, basically. We joined the military together. And the only way we wouldn't get separated was if we were married. Mm-hmm. So we got married. And I was getting out. I didn't want to stay in the military anymore. And he was supposed to get out with me. And then, like, I would say maybe a month before we were both supposed to get out of the military, they came to him and said that they would station him anywhere in the world that he wanted to be and give him this raise and, you know, different position. And they just offered him all these different bonuses. And I was like, I'm still getting out. I was like, you can do whatever it is you want to do. And he's like, well, we always wanted to go to Europe, so this would be the chance for us to be able to do that. And I was like, well, don't do that for me. You do that because that's what you want to do. And he decided to accept the offer. And so I followed him to the United Kingdom. And that's how I ended up there.
And how did you manage then to move to France? What was your step after the UK?
Even longer story. Okay, so after I moved to the UK, so I was in the UK, we're in the UK for maybe like 2 years or something. And I met my first, I guess, technically my second husband. I met my second husband there. And originally, I was a chef for a couple of years when I was in the UK, and it was a very hard job. Like, it really just kicked my ass. Like, after 3 years, I was pretty much burnt out. So at the time, I was just dating my ex-husband. We weren't husband and wife yet. And I was going to take a break. And we decided to go traveling together. So we went traveling to New Zealand and Australia, you know, for almost 2 years. And then we came back to the UK. And when I was a chef, I was working in French fine dining. So I always had this passion for French food, French cuisine. I was also reading a series of books that's by Carol Drinkwater, which is called The Olive Farm. It basically tells her story of her journey to living in the south of France, from going from the UK to living in the south of France over 20 years with all the ups and downs. And I literally kind of fell in love with the south of France through those books. And I always had a desire to go to France. And he happened to have like a lunch with an old colleague and they were talking about, I don't know, different things. And he was saying, oh yeah, my girlfriend always wanted to go to France. I guess his friend was working in France. And he was like, would you go to France? He's like, would you think about that? And he was like, why? And he was like, because we have a position opening over there. And if you would take it, I'm pretty sure I could get it for you. So he got the job and then we sold our house and we moved to France 6 months later.
Okay, that was pretty handy.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm curious because your transition been from like the Air Force to be a chef.
Yeah.
That's not like a subtle transition. Like, how did you end up to be a chef in a French chef in the UK and you're from the US?
Yes, I know. Well, because when I was in the military, I always loved to cook. I always loved to have parties. I just always loved to cook and cater things, and I would cater things for friends. And so when I was getting out of the military, I needed a profession to transition to. And to be honest, being a chef is almost military-like. Is very regimented. You have to be very organized. There's lots of creativity. And I love food. Like, food is one of my hugest passions. So I was like, well, maybe that's a profession that I can do. I didn't have to go to school. It was a profession that I could learn inside of a kitchen and work my way up. Because I still at this point, after when I got in the military, I still was not interested in going to school at all. I got a part-time job in a French restaurant before I had gotten out of the military. And I worked in this French restaurant in the evenings after work for, I don't know, about a year. And I thought, you know, this is something that I can do. So I had had some experience even before I had moved to the UK. And when I moved to the UK, like when we first arrived and we were driving onto the base, there was like a wanted sign for the officers club for a chef. I walked in and I applied for it and I got the job. And then from there, I worked at that officers club for almost a year. And then I started to work as a part-time chef in different hotels and all types of different organizations. And then I got a permanent job inside of a hotel that specialized in French fine dining, which was the type of cuisine that I was interested in the most. That was the work I did permanently after that, was working in French fine dining.
I guess from like to this point, you never been to never been to Europe till the point that you... Okay. No. What was your experience when you landed in the UK?
I mean, it was a huge culture shock, right? Because you think you both speak English. It's an English-speaking country, but it's not the same English. It's not the same culture at all. It's nothing like the States. The cars are smaller because gas costs a fortune, you know? And, you know, at first I was like, why is everybody driving these four-cylinder cars? I'm like, what's up with that? I'm like, who drives a four-cylinder car?
And the roads are much smaller too.
The roads are smaller. Petrol is expensive. They say petrol instead of gas. You know, yeah. They say, you know, you ask where the toilet is and they're like, the loo is in the back. I'm like, who's loo? I'm like, I'm looking for the toilet. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not looking for Lou. I'm looking for the toilet. Is Lou the guy who attends the toilet? Like, you know, it's just like confused in the beginning, you know? And then the pubs close at 11. So they just get ripped between like 6 and 11 o'clock. You're like, what are we speed drinking? Like, what is going on? Like, why is everyone pounding these drinks? Like, it's the last thing that's gonna, you know, it's because the shit closes at 11. You know, they're like, get it in. I'm like, okay. You know, I'm like, how am I calm down? You know, like, tomorrow there's another day. You know, it's like, it's gonna be fine. And the dating culture is different, you know, because in America, we have a huge dating culture. In Europe, there's like get drunk, fall in love culture, you know, well, especially the UK. It's like it's not this whole taking you out on dates and doing all of this stuff and all of these rules. So that was really different for me, because when I was dating guys and I was going out, like they would go out with me one or two times and think they were my boyfriend. And I was like, whoa, can, you know, push the brakes. I'm like, this is not how it works where I come from. And signed up for this, you know, so it was a huge cultural shock in so many different ways. And I think Britain has class systems. You know, the one thing I can say about the United States, there's rich and there's poor, right? But it's not necessarily a class system. In England, there's a class system. There's people who came from like royalty and people believe in that kind of stuff. And they believe in blue collared and, you know, working class and common. And that is something like ingrained in their brains. Like, you know, it's hard to move from one class system to another. Where in the United States, you can become rich. Anybody can become rich. Mm-hmm. It's not about your class or royal families or anything like that. So I kind of had to understand the history to be able to understand the mentality of the people, because it was a very difficult thing for me to get my head around class systems, because that wasn't something I really had experienced a lot. Okay, we experienced racism, different things, but classism wasn't really something I had a lot of experience with. And sort of white on white racism, like I had never seen that before. Like white people who hated other white people, you know, that was new one on me. So I was like, wow, you know, I was like, I'm learning new things. I was like, so yeah, for me, it was a whole, I learned so much from moving to England.
Because correct me if I'm wrong, but even like the way their accent, people can categorize people by their accent. If you are like a posh accent or not,
sure.
The people can distinguish just by the way you talk.
The school you went to, you know, there's so many different things that identifies you as lower class or upper class. And the system is kind of rigged against you. Like I said, it's really hard to move from one class system to another, because the classes pass on their class to their family. You know, it's like generational. It's hard to break into it unless you marry into it or something like that. And I was glad that I was American in my mind and not a European, actually, in my mind this way, because I was free to be whatever I wanted. And I believed I could be anywhere. And it doesn't matter, you know, if I was the Dutch's sister or cousin or whatever, is there still people? For me, there was no difference. But in their mind, these people are actually different for them, or they're better than them. And then for me, I just didn't have that filter. So yeah, that was just something I really had to educate myself about. And that those type of frameworks really mess with the way people believe they can achieve goals and have what they want in life if you're sort of conditioned to believe you can only be in one certain class.
And for you, that you have an American accent coming from America, were people treated differently? Did people treat you better or worse because you were American?
People always treat you better if you're American, unless you're like in the Middle East or something. But other than that, most people think it's pretty cool. I'm from Los Angeles as well. Everybody's like, ooh, LA. Everybody loves LA, right? So yeah, I think the fact that I was from LA has always helped me, no matter where I've been. Yeah, everybody's always like, Snoop Dogg. I'm like, yes, Snoop Dogg. Yes, I know. They're like, where in LA are you from? Long Beach. I'm like, man, Snoop Dogg has helped us out like a lot around the world. Everybody just like thinks LA is the coolest place because of Snoop Dogg. It's like, thanks, Snoop Dogg. Who knew?
So even then, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe you had like a good experience going to Europe because you were treated well while in the US. Correct me if I'm wrong, but even the last year and a half, like, yeah, the things that happened in the news, like racism and people against black people, where you like felt like free to be as sure more you are, like a black woman.
Of course. I mean, history has shown that, you know, black people fled to Europe, have been fleeing to Europe for a long time just to have freedom. To, you know, it's not that there's not racism, it's just that there's less violence, right? Mm-hmm. America is very violent. It's a lot of guns. You know, like, if they don't like you, they'll shoot you down and kill you, or, you know, enslave you, or try to do some crazy. You know, America's got some serious issues around violence, aggression, and oppression. And not that, you know, the English invented it, but, you know, at some point they kind of, you know, they like,
they step back and they're like, oh, maybe we went too far.
You know, there was a little bit of reflection, like, you know. And, you know, officers don't carry guns. That, when I got there, and I remember going up to a police officer asking, like, how do you get people to stop? I'm like, without a gun, what do? You just, like, yell stop and they actually stop? Like, how does that work? How does a police officer actually police without a gun? Like, I couldn't even wrap that concept around my brain. I was like, why would anyone ever listen to you if you don't have a gun in your hand? Like, this is... But they do it. Most officers don't have guns. They police. They don't have as much violent. They have like three times less the violent crimes than we do in the United States. So I think even if people are racist, they're not as violent. They're not as aggressive. It's not as life threatening as it is in the United States.
When you moved to France, was the idea that you had in your mind about France, was like a fulfilling your idea of the place you want to live?
To be honest with you, I had no idea about, I know culturally, you know, for Black Americans, lots of musicians, lots of writers, lots of philosophers, people that I admired greatly had moved to France to live. So, I mean, I did know that. And I know that there was a long history of, you know, African Americans fleeing to France and being able to find a life there. But other than that, I also heard that France was also very racist at the same time. People told me that France was a very racist country. And so I didn't know what to believe. It was kind of like a mixed bag. But for me, honestly, if I never went somewhere because people were racist, I would never go anywhere. So I just went to France and with an open mind and heart, and was like, I'm just going to see if I can, what I read in those books that made me fall in love with France, if that was what actually existed. I didn't have any permanent plans in the beginning. I just wanted to go, one, because I didn't speak French and I didn't know how capable I was going to be of learning French and to be able to actually develop a life. So I think what helped me is I had zero expectations. I just went and I decided to see if I could make a life, and I was able to. The lifestyle corresponded to the values that I wanted to live, and it's ultimately why I stayed in France, I would say.
I have to say, like, I'm a big fan of, like, no expectation or low expectation, so you don't get disappointed when you get there.
Sure.
Usually, like, it's a nice surprise. In my case, I remember when I was a kid, like the first black people that went to Italy and the job they were like selling things on the street. That's the usual job that black people had back then. They had not really a place in the society yet. And when I went to the first time in France, in Paris, I saw like black people wearing a suit to like a normal job. I felt like I loved it. Like I felt like these like people are really nice and integrated. They're so much ahead of us in France compared to Italy, because there was just because I saw like black people more integrated do like a proper job instead of just selling stuff on the street. But then I spoke to somebody else on the podcast before. It was like, no, there's actually a lot of racism in France, which was like a surprise to hear, because I thought it was like, they were like more open-minded and more integrated. Black people were like more integrated into the society.
You know, the funny thing about the United States, as racist as it is, it still has more opportunities for black people probably than anywhere in the world. Because in the United States, money talks and everything else walks. If you can make people money, they don't care what color you are. You could be a CEO of any company. If you are smart enough to convince someone you can make them money, they'll give you a chance or an opportunity. The problem with Europe is their history. It's classism. So France is the same thing. It's a classism issue. A classism issue, which turns into a racism issue. Because what happens is that you used to have royal families and you had noble families, and those families had money. And then your kids go to the best schools. And then these schools, there's only so many places to get into certain schools. There's only so many of this and that. And so the rich, the people of the upper class get all the opportunities first. And the system is kind of set up to keep people in their classes. And it just so happens is that most minorities are end up being in the lower class because they arrived in France later or in a different time of its evolution. The classism turns into racism, but it's another thing of classism. And you'll find that throughout Europe, that that's a huge issue.
So what was the things in France that make you feel like that was a place you want to settle, the place you wanted to call your home?
Well, French people value time over money. You can't buy a French person's time. I don't care how much you offer them. If they don't want to do it, they're not going to do it, because for them, time is more valuable. And for me, in my life, that's exactly the same thing. Time is the one thing you can't buy. You can't give back once it's gone. And French people value their time and having time for themselves. And they're very family oriented. They want to take their time when they eat their meals, when they have vacations, and if they want to take a sabbatical and take a year off or just to think or whatever it is they decide to do. French people are very attached to their time. You know, between the time and the food and the wine, I think I was pretty sold. You know, I was like, you know, and it's a pretty beautiful country. I mean, you have everything. You have the Alps, you have the Mediterranean Sea, you have, you know, the Massif Central, which is like this huge sort of forest that goes right across the middle of the country. You're on the border of Italy, Germany, Spain. I mean, honestly, it's just so rich. It's so full of so much. In such a small country, I can get so many things. And it's just beautiful. You know, honestly, like every time I go to a new city, a new village, a new part of France I've never seen, there's a new cheese, there's a new wine, there's a new, you know, different type of cuisine. And I never stop being impressed by France.
Were you able to work as a French chef when you moved to France?
No, I mean, when I moved to France, I was in a burnout from being a chef. I had been a chef for like 5 years in French fine dining. And you know, I worked 12 to 16 hour days, 6 days a week. I was pretty burnt out. And then when I did get married, it really, the lifestyle wasn't conducive to have like a healthy relationship. Like I was at work just all the time. So I had decided to stop being a chef. And when I came to France, I needed to learn French, and I decided to change careers at that point.
And so how did you manage to stay longer in the country?
Well, I ended up starting my own business, you know, kind of by accident. It wasn't something I had intended to do. I had came to France. I didn't speak French, but I needed to work. So I was like applying for everything from A to Z where they needed like English speakers. And I happened to apply for this job as a personal assistant for an astrologer, right? So I had to send in my birth date and time in my application form. And, you know, but the pay was good. And like the thing was just like administrative tasks. And I was still studying. So it was like the time was conducive with my course and everything. And I was like, an astrologer, I was like, I really don't care if I'm just like being a secretary. I don't care what the person does. Right. So I sent in my birth time and date and everything. And she said like, oh, she got chills when she saw my chart. And I went for an interview with this lady, and I ended up working for her for a couple of years. And because of her, I ended up starting my own apartment management and concierge business. And at the end of 5 years, I was managing like over 75 apartments in Paris. I had 7 employees and I had a full blown company. And it started by working for this Australian astrologer.
Yeah, I remember like what we spoke before doing the interview. I remember like you were telling me the story and like it was like really fascinating. Like I was telling my coworker when I went to work in that morning, like, oh, I just spoke with this person. And like the fact that you went to France and you went from like working on the Air Force to be a chef and now like working from an astrologist, and then you start your own business in France. You don't even speak the language. That was like so fascinated by your story. Like I want to tell the listener, like, how did you manage? How did you transition between like working as an assistant to your own business?
So basically when I was working for her, so she was an Anglophone, so I didn't need French to work for her. Mm-hmm. And I was still going to school. And what would happen was because she was from Australia, she would go back to Australia a couple months every year. And she would feel bad about leaving me without work. So she had other very famous astrologer friends who were also had apartments in Paris. And so she kind of would call them up and ask them if they needed any help with their stuff. And she was like, she's wonderful and she'll help you organize everything. And that's what I used to do. I used to being an assistant to, I don't know, all the famous astrologers who have properties in Paris. And I would go in and I would just sort of organize their, well, how I ended up starting the apartment management and cleaning was because when I used to work for her, she wasn't the most organized person in the world. Now I can't work if there's a mess. What I would tell her is like, well, let me organize the space, clean the space, and then we'll work. Like, and then I'll do the admin work. So this combination I had just started to become known for. So when I went to go for other work for the other astrologers, I would organize them first, and then I would do the admin work. And then when they would go back to the States or Australia, wherever they were from, they would ask me if I could look after their apartments. And sometimes they would have friends and families who would come to stay in the apartment, and I would be there to kind of open the apartment, give them the keys, sort of clean up. And I was still handling all their personal administrative stuff as well. So by the time I got to like the fifth astrologer, I was like, I can maybe turn this into a business just for Anglophones who have temporary apartments in Paris, and I can offer a personal assistant and cleaning business service. So that's what I started as. It was being personal assistant to Anglophones in Paris and also offering an organizing and cleaning service. So my business was called Organize It 123. And then it eventually turned into managing those apartments because some of those people were renting them for short vacation rentals. And it kind of just created itself. And then because all the girls who were going in school with me needed jobs as well, because they didn't speak French either, they all ended up working for me because we were all looking for jobs. So they would, you know, be personal assistants too. Some people would clean, some people would go and like give the keys and open this. And in the end, I had an apartment management, concierge and cleaning business. And it just grew, you know, like way more like a chia pet. I don't know if you remember that commercial, chia, you put water on this plant and it grows like overnight. It was kind of like that. It was like, I wasn't trying to make it into a business. I was just providing a service. I guess I found a gap in the market and it just turned into this business.
So it was that the way that you managed to stay longer in the country because you have a business? Just on the immigration perspective, like a visa, that kind of stuff?
On the immigration express, no. So when I first arrived, because my second husband was a European. Okay. So most of the time when you go to France, if you're married to a European, you can get a carte de séjour. But it's normally only for 1 year. And you have to keep renewing it every year. But because I'm astute. Now, this is one thing I have to say. If you're immigrating into a country where they have a lot of administrative bureaucracy, you have to be a huge observer. So when I used to go like to do my paperwork for my visa, I would always pay attention to who was the nicest person, who helped people. And I would literally wait for that person. Like, I would let someone go in front of me and I'd wait for the nice person. And I ended up sort of having this connection with this lady at one of the prefectures or admin office. Like, she just liked me and we really got along. And in the end, like, I was applying for my visa, but I was trying to get a 10-year visa because I was tired of doing the whole like paperwork every year. One day I came and she just like took me back to her office. She helped me fill out my paperwork. And I was like, I think the second year I came, I got my 10-year carte de séjour because of this woman. So if you're doing paperwork and stuff, you should always be really observant. Just don't go to anybody. See the person who is really interested in people and kind. But I was always prepared to. Like when I came, I had everything. And even if I didn't speak the language, like I wrote out all my questions before in French. I learned as much phrases as I could say, and which was, I think, a lot of the problem too. Like if you go to do your admin in France and you don't speak the language and they get frustrated with you and you're underprepared, it's like the worst thing you could ever do. Like they're not going to help you at all. It's going to be a nightmare. But I was super prepared. Like I would super prepare everything. And it made it really easy for her to help me, actually. And I think that that's how I got my visa so quickly.
But even see, like from your perspective, like actually from her perspective, seeing you so prepared and so willing and so like trying to communicate and trying to be, air quote, be a good guest in the country, this makes it like more motivated, more open to help you because you can see the effort on your side. Right?
And it makes their job easier. I mean, these are government workers. They see thousands of people from all countries. Nobody speaks the language. It must be an extremely frustrating job. I mean, I can only imagine, you know, and it's all paperwork, you know, and people saying, oh, I don't have my birth certificate because of this and that. You know, everybody has a sob story of why they're not prepared or why they don't have this. They probably heard every story from here to the moon. And I just didn't make excuses. And like I said, I understood. That's why I say, like, people, when they go to get their visas, they're only thinking about themselves. They're not actually thinking about the person who's doing the job on the other end. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that person. You see what they go through and how frustrating and stressful it actually is. And I think because I was trying to be considerate and empathetic, and like noticing that helped me.
Oh, I can totally say that. And speaking of the language, like how long did it take you to learn or master the French language?
Long time, long, long, long time. It took me 3 years, I would say, to get to the point where like you can go to a party and there's like, you know, more than one conversation happening and you're able to kind of follow what's going on. It took me a really long time. One, because I'm dyslexic and I didn't understand how that would affect my language learning. So I had to learn that to understand why it was taking me so long. And the second part was that I was still traveling. So I was still taking time in and out. So I was having like breaks in and out of the language. And another problem was that my business was working with Anglophones. I really had to force myself to put myself in situations to force me to speak French, because if I didn't, I could have so easily have just stayed in this sort of Anglophone bubble and never have learned the language. So I made a dedicated effort sort of every day to do something in French. But, you know, I say they call them romance languages because you need to be in love with them to actually learn them because they're so complicated. Like if it's a romance language, that just means extremely complicated. You need to love this language because this is going to be hard as hell. You know, like, pretty much.
Oh, no, I totally understand it. Like people say like, oh, English languages are like a. Yeah, no, it's not. It's really not. Like, I'm glad I learned Italian when I was a kid, when I grew up learning Italian, because like so many, you need to remember so many words.
Yeah.
Like every single subject's got its own verb in different ways and different, like it's so much to remember. Like, and now that I speak English most of the time, I started forgetting Italian. Like, I don't know.
Don't forget your Italian. Don't do it because you'll kick yourself.
I'm not forgetting, but I definitely get rusty. Like I was talking with a friend the other day and like keep saying like, how do you say that in Italian?
He's like, what's wrong with you, man? You better move back before you lose your vibe.
Yeah, I just need to watch some Italian movies or something to like refresh my Italian.
Yes, I know what you mean. I mean, but that's the same thing, you know, like people think that that's funny, but that's the thing with language. If you don't use it, you lose it. And that was the problem. So when I was traveling and going away for a month or 3 months, I wasn't speaking French. And it was like, poof, all that progress I had made, I had to redo, you know, because I wasn't using it. So I would lose it. And I kept having to repeat and repeat into a point where I was just like, you know what, I'm just not going to travel for a while. And I just need to wait until I have a really strong grasp on the language before I go hopping off, because I just kept sort of regressing every time.
And do you have any particular advice that you want to give to the listener that maybe they're planning to go to France or they're planning to go somewhere else and need to learn a language? Do you have a thing that helped you the most to try to learn the language?
I would say don't be cheap. You get what you pay for. It's like wine. You know, you pay $1.50. I mean, what do you really expect?
Good hangover.
You know what I mean? It's not going to be great. I would say it wasn't until like I sort of made a proper investment in a school that not only taught me the language, it taught me about the culture. It focused on pronunciation. It focused on the psychological way of learning a language, learning language that you're going to actually use. Because if you just learn all of this stuff and you're not using it, it doesn't go into your long-term memory. It just gets dumped. And you don't make any progress. So it's making sure that when you're learning the language, it's serving a purpose. Like you pull out of it what you can use immediately and you need to start using it. Like at the butcher's, at the bakery, at the grocery store, anywhere, anytime you can force yourself. You have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and looking like an idiot. You have to not care about that at all. And just try to use whatever language you have. If you worry about being perfect before you speak, you'll never make any progress.
Absolutely. The mistakes are part of the learning. It's probably the best, like a teacher, like making mistakes and
yeah.
Say something silly. Yeah.
And honestly, most of the time, especially in France, because French people don't like to look like they don't know things. So even if they speak English, but they think they speak bad English, they're not going to speak English with you. But if you try to speak bad French to them, then they feel okay to speak to you in their bad English. So now you're both practicing, you know? But if you don't make any effort, they just won't speak to you. They'll just speak French at you. And you're like, I know they speak English and whatever. But if they don't feel comfortable, that's what I say. When people are doing things, you also have to think about the other person you're in front of. It's not just about you. It is also about the other person. They may be just as uneasy with speaking English as you are uneasy about speaking French. And the way that you can meet someone in the middle is by making an effort. And you will progress just a lot faster that way. And people will help you more if you make the effort.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love your way of thinking. Think of the other person, not just yourself. But going back to your career, like, you have like this growing business and all of that. What was your transition after this business?
Yeah. So after, you know, the apartment management business grew, like I said, unexpectedly. This was not something I had actually planned on doing with my life. This wasn't like my purpose. I was like, I don't want to be a managing apartments. It was just something that happened to me and it ended up being extremely successful. And it got to the point where like other businesses, apartment management services wanted to subcontract my business, which means I would have had to have grown my business substantially to do that. And I had clients who wanted to invest in my business to grow it. But I wasn't sure because I wasn't really happy with what I was doing. It was working. I was making money, but I wasn't happy. And so those investors said, look, they paid for me to go to a life coach for 6 weeks. They was like, we're going to pay for you to go to this life coach to work out any problems you think that you have with your business. And that way you'll know for sure if you want to continue and grow it. If you do, we would like to invest. And if you don't, well, at least you know and you'll move on and do something else. So I went to the life coach and I decided I didn't want to keep the business. And what I decided that what I did like about the part of my business was sort of the personal management of people's lives. Like all these people's lives that I was managing and organizing, that was the part that was the most interesting. So I decided that was the part I was going to keep. And I thought that was closer to coaching than it was to apartment management. And so at that time, I was really into wellness. So I decided, sold the business, took the money. I went back to school and got a degree in alternative medicine. And I got my certificate in life coaching. and I was going through a separation. So I had moved to London. And so I restarted my life and career in London as a life and wellness coach. After 3 years in London and the rain and the gray and the bad weather, I was like, I want to come back to France. And I came back to France and decided to come to the south of France, where they had no idea what a life coach was. Rosé was their life coach. They were like, you got any problems? There's sun and rosé. Like, who has problems with rosé? I'm like, no one. You're right. Like, how am I going to have a career here? Like, these people don't have any problems. You know? They're not stressed. There's no anxiety. You know, you can't buy their time. They're sitting in the sun. They're having a coffee for 3 hours. I mean, what problems do these people really have?
So what, did you become a winemaker?
No, I found Anglophones who have problems and stress and anxiety and whose time can be bought. And those are the people that I coach. You know, on a serious note, I coach people who went through the same things I went through. I had to adapt. I had to learn languages. I had to learn different cultures. I had to, you know, I lived in different places for, you know, short term, long term, all of those things. And I managed them all quite successfully. And so I just started coaching people from my life experience on how to navigate an expatriate life, and that especially if you're a trailing spouse or someone who a digital nomad, you really have to understand how we say, measure your expectations, to rely on all the skills that you have, because you're not going to be able to do everything that you want to do everywhere that you want to go. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a fulfilling experience doing something else. And what I really do is kind of go in and help people find the multifacets of themselves so that they can be successful no matter where they are. You know, me being an international life and business coach is based around that I help people sort of develop themselves personally, also with a practical knowledge of business, so that they can be successful no matter where they are. That if you know yourself and what you're capable of, it's easier to navigate that journey no matter where you may end up.
Yeah, I remember last time we had a conversation, you were talking about like how important it is to find your it.
Yes.
Is that what you were talking about, referring to, finding the purpose? Or?
Yes. I mean, I think we all have something that we're drawn to. You know, it's like if you always find yourself listening to science shows or documentaries, or you love personal development, or there's something that we're all innately drawn to. I think there's something inside of us that is just natural. And a lot of times that naturalness, or those, I would say what we call those minor skills, we don't listen to them because we think is going to earn us the most money or make us the most successful or make us the most or fit the structure of the life we're in for our parents, for us, or what society tells us. That's what we focus on. And we shut out all the other stuff. But every person is multifaceted. They have tons of skills and abilities. A lot of them are complementary. They just can't see it because they've only been looking at it from one way. I mean, for me, it sounds like I've had like so many different professions, but not really. I went from the military to being a chef, which I'm telling you was literally like being in the military. It was very regimented. You had to be on it and focused. So like the skills, one, I'm an adaptable person. So I didn't want to be in the military, but I could adapt. I needed it to survive. So I just swallowed the hard pill, did what I needed to do to survive, and I adapted. I got out. What did I do? I did it again. I took a skill that I just learned and I transformed it into a different job. I moved to France. Same thing. My skill is adaptability, connecting with people, and when a door opens, walking through it, right? And having the discipline and the courage enough to stick with something and having really low expectations, right? Just as you were saying, like, you can't get disappointed if you don't have any expectations. So I always give myself the chance to see what I can do. And lots of people won't do that. They won't permit themselves to just try something and lean on their soft skills to sort of really add to the major qualities that they actually may have. So when being an expat, you really have to know what your skills are, what you are good at and how they can be transformed in any situation to serve you. And the jobs will be can be totally different, but they still may take the same skills.
How do you think, like, is there a way for people to find what their passion is, what their hit is?
Sure. It's just, you know, it's as old as the Bible. It says, know thine self. Most people don't spend enough time getting to know themselves and what they're actually capable of. And so, you know, when people work with me, we kind of go through an inventory of themselves and their lives and getting them into the process of understanding themselves and what they are actually capable of and pushing them to test out and to try all of their skills in one way, shape, or form to see if something clicks, if something opens the door. You know, I think for a lot of people working with me, it gives them the permission to try. I sort of help people take calculated risks. Most people want to feel stable. They want to be secure. They don't want to feel like they're giving up everything. It seems too risky. It may seem risky to their family or to their partner or to even to themselves, too insecure to change. What I do as a coach is to help them to take calculated risks, to slowly to understand what they have of value and how they can slowly start to transition to see if how they can turn that value into something that's going to give them the stability, happiness, fulfillment, and security that they're looking for. And it doesn't happen overnight. It is a transition. You know, confidence grows with doing things. And my job is to get to help people to do that.
Another thing we were talking about last time was like reconditioning yourself. You mentioned something that you kind of learn in the military, the process, the training you go through, the kind of like a reconditioning yourself. And you told me last time, this is actually a great skill to achieve something great in life, achieving your goals or achieving your dreams just for like a reconditioning yourself.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what this means? What's reconditioning?
I think a lot of people would have to understand that most people don't understand how the mind works. The mind is the most powerful thing a human being has. And if you don't know how it works, to be successful in life is very difficult. Now, the one thing the military does do, it understands the mind, it understands psychology, and it understands human behavior. So when a human being enters the military, I don't care who you are, what they'll do is they're going to break you down. They're going to break down everything life taught you, everything your parents taught you, everything life taught you. And they're going to reprogram you to think like a soldier because that's what they need. They need soldiers. They need people who can take orders, that are going to do what they tell them to do and make them believe that the reason they're doing it is to make their country better and to give people freedom and to do all of this. You know, they have to sort of brainwash you in a way for you to be willing to risk your life, to go out there and to give your life for something that they have just programmed you to believe in a very deep way. And the thing is that you can do that for yourself. You can be your own drill sergeant. You can program your mind to work for you, but you have to know how the mind works to be able to do that. Now, the mind has a filter. The mind only will search for and help you find the things that it believes are important to you. So let's say you always loved coaching, like you wanted to be a referee or something. Like you love watching it, but you've never done it. Like it's just a sport. It's like a passion, but it's something you never permitted yourself to see if you could actually do yourself. So your mind thinks this is not important. So I'm not going to focus on how I could actually be a referee because I'm telling my mind this is not important. This is just a sport. This is a hobby. But if you want to do something, you want to change something, you want to create something, you want to draw something into your life, you have to program that filter. There is a system tested in every profession, everywhere, especially with athletes, on how to program that filter because the mind doesn't know the difference between imaginary and real. That's why we have to make it real in the mind first if we want to make it real in our external lives. Part of my coaching is about that, is about helping people to train that filter, to train their minds, to bring them the success and the results that they're looking for, and how to get their mind to start searching to bring them the things that they want. Now, when we talk about my story, I was always a journaler. I was always creating a vision type person or a vision board type of person. So I was training my mind without actually understanding what I was doing until later on in life. you know, once I became a coach and understood more about the psychology of the mind and how the military had even trained me to become, you know, this party girl into a soldier was a very interesting thing to understand. And once I understood that if I convinced my mind of it, it will make it happen. Things like opportunities, like all the things that I just told you, I wanted to move to Europe. It just somehow these things just kept showing up because I was always had visioning, seeing myself, doing all the things that I wanted to do, not knowing how they were going to happen, but preparing myself sort of mentally for them to happen. So when the door opened, I was mentally prepared to go through it. It didn't catch me by surprise. I was willing and ready mentally to seize any opportunity that walked up to me. And that's what I try to teach people, is to understand the power of their mind and how to train that filter to work for them.
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting experiment that they did with athletes, as you mentioned. I think they divided these basketball player into two groups. Mm-hmm. One group was like a shooting baskets, yep, all 4 hours, and the other one was just thinking,
visualizing
exactly like a shooting and score the points. And I think they tested afterwards. I think the people that actually didn't do any training, they just visualized, actually performed better than people that trained all day long.
It's a famous study. And there are tons of studies. The military has studies older than that for soldiers. That's how they know how to train soldiers. The military knows more about the mind probably than anybody, because they have to train you to sacrifice your life. You know how you have to understand the psychology of human beings to get them to sacrifice their lives for something? You have to condition them. And the thing is that we can condition ourselves to perform and do extraordinary things. Soldiers do extraordinary things because they believe in it. They believe they're doing this for a higher purpose. And you can program yourself to believe in yourself enough to do whatever it is you need to do to achieve whatever it is that you need to achieve. But you have to keep seeing yourself doing it. You have to visualize it. And then it just ends up being your life. Like, I can't exactly explain how that works, but the thing is that the brain just focuses on that, because now you said it's important. Like, it's important for me to find a job or to find a career or to learn this language. So what is it going to do? It's just going to focus on everything that you just told it was important. And the thing is that most people have dreams and they don't believe in those dreams. They have them, but they don't believe in them. And so they'll never achieve them. The first thing about achieving anything is first convincing yourself that it's important and that you can do it. And then everything follows after that.
Yeah. And speaking of achieving, after you lived abroad for so many years, do you have any regrets about having left your country?
No, zero. Zero. And Donald Trump confirmed my choice, I must say. You know, and I don't think Trump was all bad. You know, like, there are some things, you know, the guy had a point with certain things, like industry should come back to the United States. I didn't totally disagree with everything about Donald Trump. He was just an egomaniac. But I think what has happened to the United States, the American dream, it's been lost. Like, when people are like telling people to go back where you came from, like, what are you talking about? The United States was founded on immigrants. The only native people are Native Americans. Every single person is an immigrant in the United States. But it's like, they've lost sight of that. And people came there to have religious freedom and to be able to have opportunities that they couldn't have anywhere else. And that is slowly changing. And that door is closing. And people are forgetting what it was founded on in the first place. And that's sad. And when I go back to my country, it doesn't feel the same way anymore. Like, the gap between the rich and the poor is the largest it's ever been. And people don't have a good standard of living. And no, I don't miss it at all. And I think the fact that education puts people in debt for over 10 to 20 years of their life, that's not a system I miss at all, and not one that I want for my child, for that matter.
And what's the biggest upside about immigrating, about moving to France?
Well, once you have a European passport, you can live and work anywhere in Europe. And so that's pretty cool. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, if this place sucks, you just hop over to Italy or Germany or, you know, wherever, you know, that's in the European Union. So, you know, that's pretty cool. I mean, the UK used to be in there, and then they went crazy. But, you know, it kind of opens the door to lots of different cultures and different experiences that you can have. without having to apply for a visa. You know, you could go anywhere in the European Union and live and work with no problem.
It's so cheap to fly as well.
Yes. Traveling is easy. Everything is easy. Living is easy. I'm not going to go bankrupt because I went in an ambulance or because I went to the doctor or because I had a baby. I remember one time I had went to the doctor in France. I had some sort of issue. I needed to go to the hospital like every day for x-rays for over 2 weeks. I was like, I'm gonna have to sell something. Like when this bill comes, I'm gonna have to sell something, right? Like I was just like paranoid. And because they were like, do you have a mutual, which is like a medical insurance? So you have the mm-hmm. social system, but people still have medical insurance to cover the rest, whatever the government doesn't cover. So I was like, no, I don't. Right. So she was like, oh, so you're going to have to pay for this out of pocket. Right. And I'm thinking to myself, this is going to be thousands of dollars. Like my American brain is like kicked in. And she was like, $235. I was like, excuse me. She was like, that would be 200. I was like, for 2 weeks of scans, doctor's visits, medication, you only want 200. I was like, here, look, you take this check. Have fun. Like, because I mean, like I was literally flabbergasted, because if that was in the United States, I would have had to sell my house. Mm-hmm. That would have cost me so much money. So it's just that you feel like, oh, you can get medical care and it's not going to bankrupt you. You, like I say, if I went to back to the university right now, I could get a degree, a master's degree. It would cost me like $2,000 maybe. Mm-hmm. Max. I mean, in the States, that's just unheard of. So, you know, it's just those things, like you just feel like your standard of living is just better in every way. And it's accessible to every single human, every citizen, not rich, poor, big, fat, black, white. If you're a citizen, you have the right to these services. That's just beautiful. And everyone takes care of, feels as though every human life has a standard of living that they should have. And the United States has lost sight of that. You know, everyone is a human being and we all deserve a minimum standard of living. And in Europe, you get that, you know, at least the ones whose economy is doing okay.
And in your like journey of moving abroad and settling to France, do you remember like one particular thing? What was the most challenging thing that you have to face in your moving abroad and settling in France?
Culturally, you know, it's culturally very different. You know, being American, you know, we're very loud, you know, open. You know, we believe, we literally believe like we could do or be anything. Like we literally believe that. Like that's what we grow up believing. That's what everyone tells us since the time we're born. And when you have like a skill or you're good at something, you flaunt it. You know, you promote yourself. It's like, you know, the world is all about me right now. And that's not a bad thing. And France is not like that. You know, people are very conservative. It's a social system. So that means there's a lot of conformity. It's less individualistic, which has its ups and downsides. People don't wear bright colors. And, you know, it's all those small things that can be part of your personality that when you're confronted with a social norm that is quite different from that, you have to decide what you're going to do with yourself at that point. Some people try to erase their personality. Some people try to integrate a bit of both. And for me, that was the challenge. It was understanding how I was going to integrate my personality and who I was into this culture that was actually quite very different from mine. And so I'm a mix of both. But that took some time to get there.
Yeah, I bet. And do you feel lucky to be an immigrant?
Yes, I feel blessed, you know, just to be alive and, you know, looking at the Mediterranean Sea every morning when I wake up. You know, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. You know, I you know, I eat good food and good wine and things every single day. You know, there's so much wine in this country. You could, you know, it's just like insane, and so much good food and the time you have to just enjoy your life. Yes, I mean, I feel extremely grateful to be here where I am at this point. Definitely.
And looking back, is there anything that you may think like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or I shouldn't have done that differently? Is there anything that you wouldn't have done differently?
I think I would have gotten more support. What a lot of expatriates do, they think they have to go it all alone. And most people do. And they suffer a lot. And they suffer from isolation. They lose confidence, insecurity. you know, it's part of the expat experience that shouldn't be anymore. It's not shameful to get support. It's not shameful to reach out. It's not shameful to say, I'm not understanding how to integrate into this culture or to this place. Like, it may have worked in the last place you were, but in the new place, you're like, holy crap, I don't understand anything. And it can happen because, you know, the way women are treated is different in every country. The way certain professions viewed are different in every country. Like, being a plumber in Germany is respected. Being a plumber in France, not so much. So this could be a blow to your self-esteem. Like, you once had a job that was looked at as something, you know, useful and admirable and something everyone needs, to it being looked at as a lower class job. These things change how you show up in the world. And sometimes you need support to integrate or to readapt or to change into a new life. And you don't have to suffer doing it alone. I suffered a lot doing it alone because at the time I didn't know any expat coaches. I mean, the time they sent me to that coach when I had my business, that was the first time I really had an experience of really having some support. And then from that time on, I always got support. But until that moment, I mean, I had already lived in Europe for almost 8 years at the point where I finally had some support. And I was just like, Jesus, why didn't I not have this before? Like, this would have just saved me so much time. And especially if it's an expat coach who already knows what you're going to go through, what you're going to experience, it's just going to save you time. So I would say, don't waste your time. Invest in yourself. Get the support you need in any way that you need it. And even if you're a trailing spouse and you're not the money earner, your well-being is worth it. Your mental health and the way you show up in the world is worth the investment. For your language classes, down to getting a coach to help you integrate, or, you know, whatever makes you feel like a better person mentally, physically, and emotionally, that is something you should never hesitate to invest in.
I agree 100%. Even because, like, if you don't know what you're going through, you put too much pressure on yourself that you're not good enough, you're not capable.
And your relationships.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely agree. And one last thing that we were discussing here before the interview that you mentioned, you have a podcast as well. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about the podcast?
Yes, I have a podcast as well. It's actually a radio show that comes on twice a week on World Radio Paris. It's called Living La Belle Vie. And then I repurpose the content to all the podcasts like Google and everything like that. So you can find it there. So it's called Living La Belle Vie. And basically, I interview expats and professionals to give people tips on how to navigate, to help them to navigate the expatriate experience better, to kind of learn from other people and other people's experiences or other professionals so that they don't have to waste their time doing the same mistakes. Like, you can listen to someone else's experience, learn from them, take those tips from those people, and hopefully apply them to your life in some way. And also to learn about things that you maybe didn't know about. You know, I had a expatriate sort of financial advisor, tons of stuff. Even myself, when I had the lady on my show, I was like, ooh, I do need to think about my social contributions from this country to that country and this country, how I'm going to put all of that together. So it's really just giving people information to help them navigate their expat experience better. And it's called Living La Belle Vie, and you can find it pretty much everywhere.
Sweet. So guys, if you like this podcast, I'm pretty sure you're going to love our podcast as well. So one last question. If people wants to get in touch with you, want to connect with you, or where people can find you?
Well, I keep it simple. Everything is Monday Young Coaching. So Facebook, Monday Young Coaching. Instagram, Monday Young Coaching. My website is www.mondayyoung.com. So literally, if you type in my name, you can just find me everywhere. Everything is Monday Young Coaching on LinkedIn, Twitter. It's all the same everywhere. So Monday Young Coaching, and you'll find me somewhere, somehow. That's for sure.
Sweet. To make it this even more simple, like, everything will be in the show notes. one click away.
That too.
Also, thank you, Monday, for taking the time to do this interview, sharing your story and wisdom. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. I told you, like, when we spoke the first time, like, your sense of humor and laugh is like a contagious. And I mean, we spoke about this when we were talking, like even like the moving, having your sense of humor, your American sense of humor, and then translated to French, and like how tricky that can be,
it
right?
It can, extremely, because I laugh loud as well, you know, and they don't, French people don't laugh loud. And I was like, why is everyone looking at me, you know? my American cackle, like, you know? And I laugh all the time, you know, so it's just, yeah, but I found a balance, you know. I try to just tone it down a bit in the restaurant, you know, like, it's just like, you know?
Like for Italian, like the gesture is like,
I love Italy
though.
Need
to keep it down a little bit.
In Italy, I laugh as loud as I want. Also in Brazil, like Italy, I love, like they're so expressive and everyone's making noise and talking over each other. Yeah. Like, I love this place. You're like,
maybe your next destination.
Maybe. I'd be as big as a house if I lived in Italy, though. All that pasta, like, dude, I'd be like 280 pounds. They have to roll me out of Italy. I'm like, oh, I just can't stop.
I need to, every time I go back to Italy, I need to be ready. I need to look at the start of my diet before I go to Italy so I can put my more weight when I go there.
Yeah.
Like, you want to go there, you want to have the full experience. You don't want to, like,
exactly.
Oh, back, like, oh, no, I'm not going to have that because I already ate too much. No, that's part of the,
you're just going to unbutton that button, you know, that button at the top. That's Italy. You go to Italy, you need either elastic pants or ones that you can unbutton very discreetly. That's pretty much your Italian experience.
You just unveiled my trick.
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mandy.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week and stick until the end. If you enjoyed this episode and found it useful, please share with your friends, coworkers, and social media so we can help more people on their journey abroad. And make sure to follow Immigrants Life on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss any future episode. And if you want to support us and the work we do, you could leave an honest review. It only takes a few minutes, but it really helps a lot with the algorithm. You can find the link of all the resources mentioned in this episode in the show notes by clicking on the link in the description or by visiting immigrantslife.com/episode61. If you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Immigrants Life and Facebook at Immigrants Life Podcast. Thanks again for listening and talk to you in the next one. Ciao.